Okay, now we're being recorded. I wasn't recording before, but now we are. So this is lab eight, experiment eight, and you would have been given an unknown. The unknown in experiment eight has a list of, it's like 50 to 75 unknowns. They are all different functional groups, all different hazard classes. And you were given a complete unknown. Everybody in the class would have had their own. There would have been no duplicates. And you would have been asked to take the boiling point on the compound and then to run the FTIR on the compound. The boiling point would have gotten you to within about five compounds. So the compounds were all listed in boiling point with ranges of about plus or minus 5 degrees. And within plus or minus 5 degrees, there was generally five compounds of all different functional groups. Maybe a few more, maybe up to eight. Then by taking the FTIR tells you what functional groups are in the compound. It can distinguish between alcohols, aldehydes, ketones, esters, carboxylic acids, alkanes, alkenes, alkynes. It can distinguish between the major functional groups. Then you go back and use the boiling point and the 5 to 8 compounds you narrowed it down to. You use the FTIR to narrow down functional group. Now you narrow it down to 2 or 3 compounds. And those 2 or 3 compounds, you look up the FTIR of each of the 2 or 3 compounds, compare them to the FTIR that you took that is acting like a fingerprint, and you find a fingerprint match. And when you find that match, you know what your compound is. So that was the goal. It's a 3-day lab because it takes time for people to go through and do the boiling points. And it takes time to be able to run everybody through the FTIR, show you how it works, and have everybody do their scans. So it was a 2 to 3 day lab, and we pretty much condense it down into a 1-day lab lecture in this format. However, I think on the second day, what we'll do is I'm gonna put together some spectra and put them up and then have us discuss the spectra and try to figure out what the spectrum functional groups are, and then show you some other spectrums and see if we can't come up with a functional group match or the compound match. So we'll go through and we'll show how the lab would have been done in practice. And I might even be able to develop a quiz that has a limited number of unknowns. And you could go through and get the boiling point, get the spectrum, and then using some online resources, you would be able to compare that spectrum and figure out what the spectrum actually is. So that's kind of the overview of what we're going to do. And I think we ought to just jump in and start looking at the boiling points and how boiling point works. Okay. Any questions in terms of where we're going, what we're doing, or what the plan is for today? Nope. All right, let's jump into it. Let's talk boiling points. Boiling points are a little bit more tricky than our melting points. They do the same thing for liquids as a melting point does. But wherein as a melting point has a range, boiling points don't have a range. Boiling points are a single measurement. So first off, how do we do the boiling point? And some differences. Two ways to do the boiling point. One is to take an Erlenmeyer flask or a beaker that has the material in question, and to heat it up, throw some boiling points in there, and then see when it boils. So we could just heat it on a hot plate and watch when the thing boils. However, it requires a large volume, and many of these materials are not very pleasant to work with. And if you have a large volume of them, you just subject yourself to much more exposure of the chemicals. And so that's not an ideal means of doing that. Plus, everything that you utilize in terms of the test would generally then be hazed out. And that would be a lot of material to throw away for very expensive chemicals. On a smaller scale, what used to be done is to take and use that melting point, boiling point device that was sort of interestingly shaped. It was a test tube that had an arm out on the side. And you would take a smaller test tube that had like a splint or something stuck down into it, and then the liquid, and the splint would act as a boiling stone, essentially. Or you could throw a couple little boiling stones in there, and you put a thermometer next to it. And this thing is filled with oil. And the oil is filled up to here, and we would heat the outside with a Bunsen burner. Not my favorite thing to do, because you're heating it up. Plus, you're still using a fairly large volume. I mean, this is, when you were working in a beaker, you're using 15 to 20 mils in an Erlenmeyer flask. In a test tube like this, you still might be using 2 to 5 mils in an apparatus like that. And so ideally what we'd like to be able to do is we'd like to be able to do a boiling point in a melt temp. And trying to do it in a melt temp has its challenges. So to do it in a melt temp, we have to get the sample into that little capillary tube. And then once it's in that capillary tube, it's not exactly clear how we're going to conduct the boiling, because boiling stones won't fit in that capillary tube. And you could say, well, we could just put some little pixie dust down in there and see if that would boil in terms of a melt temp, but it doesn't really work that way. So melt temps need to be done in a unique way. We can't use boiling stones. So we need to come up with another way in order to be able to use the boiling, to use the melt temp in order to do boiling points. So one of the things that we can do is we could go back to the definition of what the boiling point is. The boiling point is the point at which the pressure of the vapor of a liquid is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere pushing on it. So that's where the boiling point is. And so if we had a way of realistically measuring the vapor pressure of the liquid up against the atmospheric pressure of a liquid, then we could know what the boiling point was. Let's see if you guys remember this experiment. There was an experiment that you did that was molar mass of a gas, and it's done in Chem 3. I don't know how many people took Chem 3. And what we did there is we used a constructed device of an Erlenmeyer flask that was upside down in some water. And we used a tube to put gas into here, and we connected this to a gas tank where we blew butane into it. And the butane, this vessel was originally filled with water. So there was water all inside this vessel and no air bubbles. And then as we put the gas inside it, so there's water all out here too, as we put the gas inside this container, what happens is it displaces the water that's inside there. So let's say that we're putting gas into it. And as we put the gas comes in. Oh, it's going to erase everything. I don't want to erase everything. I want partial. As we put the gas in, air bubbles start to displace the water. And we displace the water all the way down until we get close to the tapered part of the flask. And then we have this ability to be able to move the flask up and down. And it creates three unique situations. It creates a situation where if I look at the flask sitting upside down in the beaker, that I could have the height of the water in the flask and in the beaker like that. And this is where the pressure of the gas is pushing down at that level, and the pressure of the atmosphere is pushing on the outside here, and we would say that the pressure of the gas is greater than the pressure of the atmosphere. We could look at the case where, where I could take that beaker and we could have the level of the water inside the flask and the level outside the flask is such that here the pressure of the gas is less than the pressure of the atmosphere, because the pressure of the atmosphere is pushing here and the pressure of the gas is pushing there. Or if those levels are equal, we would say that the pressure of the gas is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere. So as I have it on the left-hand side, the pressure of the gas pushing inside is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere, which is at the level where we want when doing that experiment. We can use that idea of pressure and gas and pressure of atmosphere pushing on water in an upside down sort of sense to be able to measure our boiling point by creating an experiment much like the one on the left, only in a capillary tube. So what we're going to do is, in order to do that, we are going to construct a capillary tube. And inside our capillary tube, we're going to put a small amount of the liquid that we want to measure its boiling point. And then inside of that, we will put another capillary tube, a smaller capillary tube. And this capillary tube will have an open bottom and a closed top. And then that whole thing will go into the melt temp device and we will heat it up until we see boiling. And so essentially, this is a melt temp tube with a smaller tube and we're going to call this smaller capillary the dumbbell. Because of its shape, because of the fact that it's going to be closed at the top and open at the bottom, and its top will have a little ball of glass on it, that dumbbell that goes inside has to be really tiny. And basically the way that we make that is we take the pulled out pipette, like when we were doing TLC, and we pull out a pipette and we use one of those pipettes that's been pulled out for the capillary tube. So we stretch that whole thing out and we use both ends of the pipette this time. We have some other jobs for this thing. So this gets pulled out into a really fine little capillary. And this is the size tube that we wind up using. Okay, and so we'll break this off and we take and we make the dumbbell out of that. And we'll use the other end. We'll use this end here as our micropipette. So we're gonna get a couple of pieces out of this that are gonna help us in order to be able to do the boiling point. So the first thing that we do is we add the sample to the capillary tube. We do that by taking the capillary tube. Here's our sample. So the samples come in a 3 mil dram vial, and they have a screw top lid on them. And then you've got a small amount of liquid that you've been given inside of that. So let's make that liquid red. Okay, so here's our sample. What we do is we take, sorry, I had to get that thing off my screen. You take the capillary tube that we've created, the end of it that is the micropipette. And they're a little longer than I'm going to draw. I'm going to draw it kind of short here at first. And this tube sucks liquid up through capillary action. So you don't need a pipette bulb. You just dip it into the solution. So this is our sample unknown. I don't want to say solution because it's a pure liquid. It's not really a solution. It's just the sample unknown. So you suck up some of that sample unknown. And then what you do is you take that and you take the capillary tube, which is the tube from the melt temp. And this is looking a little bigger than what that melt temp tube is. but it'll help us to see what's going to happen. And we insert this micro pipette into it. Once the micro pipette is inserted with its liquid in it, then what we're going to do is we're going to use just a little bit of thumb pressure to push on this capillary tube. And the liquid right now is just sitting inside the capillary tube. But we're going to cause it to be deposited, not with a pipette bulb, because a pipette bulb would exert too much force and would just blow stuff everywhere. So what I literally do is I take your thumb and apply your thumb on top of this with just a little bit of thumb pressure, and we push down on it. And when you push down on it, your thumb actually pushes into the opening a little bit, compressing the gases that are inside here. And as you compress the gas, the droplets come out. And we get a little bit of liquid that fills inside this capillary tube. And so you just push a little bit out, and then there'll be some droplets on the side of the tube, and you tap them down. And once you tap them down, they all settle down into the bottom of the tube, and we've applied our liquid sample into the tube with just using that micropipette and no pipette bulb. So now we're sitting there and we have our filled capillary tube with liquid. The next thing that we do is we make that dumbbell, and we have to close off the dumbbell and insert it into this tube. So to close off the dumbbell, what we do is we take a piece of glass that is the really fine capillary tube, and we take it over to the Bunsen burner. Both ends are open because we've broken it apart. We take it over to the Bunsen burner, and we twist it right on the edge of the flame. We just kiss it to the flame. And as we kiss it to the flame, what happens is there's a little bit of yellow color that comes off the flame that arises right where the glass kisses it. And that flame, remember, has that little blue cone down at the bottom, and it's a little bit more orangey at the top. And the heat from that flame closes it up instantly. I use just a little bit of twirling motion. So I take this and I kind of twirl it around in my fingers as I kiss it on the edge of the flame, holding it from the bottom down below the Bunsen burner. I even take this and make it slightly more extreme angle. Let me show you. So that what I do is I come up from the bottom of the Bunsen burner and just sort of kiss it right there on the edge and twirl it around. And as you do so, the glass melts, fuses, and makes a tiny little ball on the end of it, such that what it looks like when you're done is you have this little tiny capillary tube that is now open on the bottom, and you get a little ball of glass on the top that is sealed. We take the open end and we put the opened end into the capillary tube and get it to go all the way down to the bottom. And the only trick about this that is the height of the inner dumbbell that you create, that we want the height of the inner dumbbell to be about twice the height of the liquid. So it kind of sits there inside. The opened end is at the bottom, the closed end is at the top. Then what we do is we take that whole thing and put it into the melt temp, and then we crank up the temperature on it until we get the material to boil. And this is where it gets a little bit challenging, is trying to figure out how to actually observe the boiling point. So one, add sample into the capillary tube. Two, make the dumbbell. Three, add the dumbbell to the capillary tube. Okay. Now we're going to take the melting point, or taking the boiling point. As we heat this tube up, what's going to happen is, I'm going to draw an expanded sort of picture. So let's say this is our capillary tube. And I have the inner capillary. And so this image extends up, and I'm just cutting off the picture to make it a little bit easier to see. And inside here, we have our sample. That is not going to work. Inside here, we have our sample. So much better. And at the outset, what is inside this tube is air. Because the top of the tube is fused, it does not act like a capillary tube, and it does not suck liquid up into it. The air that is in there excludes liquid from being able to go up into the capillary tube. So when we first put it in there, and it's at room temp, nothing happens. As we heat it, and we apply heat, the air that is inside the capillary tube starts to expand. And as it expands, it comes out, and we see bubbles. So we start to see air bubbles that start to come out of this guy. Those air bubbles, as they come out rather slowly, and they oftentimes come out as fairly large bubbles. As we continue to heat it, all of the air has expanded, and there is now theoretically no air inside the capillary tube. What's inside the capillary tube is the vapor pressure of the liquid itself. So at this point, once we've heated it enough, the air is now gone, and what is inside here is the pressure of the gas formed from our sample. So we have pressure, gas, no more air. However, what we still have is we still have bubbles that are forming, which is supposedly the boiling happening. And this happens a little bit more rapidly and a little bit more vigorously. The problem is that we weren't boiling before, so this was not boiling, but there was bubbles, and this is boiling, still bubbles, and the question is, when did I transition from not boiling to boiling when bubbles were coming out the entire time? And there's no real way to tell when you actually transitioned from those bubbles that were air to the bubbles that are now boiling. And so you overshot the boiling point and you don't know where boiling actually happened. We're going to go back to this idea, this concept right here, that the boiling point is where the pressure of the gas is equal to the pressure of the atmosphere. That's what boiling point is. And so if I can get the two levels to be equal, a level inside the capillary tube and the level outside the capillary tube, then I'll know what the boiling point is. And the only way that I can do that is to take the system and to cool down the system. So if I take the system and cool it down, I'll just move this over a little bit, so that now what I do is I reduce the heat. And cool down. Eventually, I will drop below the boiling point. And as I drop below the boiling point, what winds up happening is the liquid bubbles will stop. And at some point, as the bubbles stop, the liquid will take a turn and will go inside the capillary tube and start to fill the capillary tube. As the liquid starts to fill the capillary tube, this is my boiling point. This is where the pressure of the vapor is now equal to the pressure of the atmosphere, because the pressure of the atmosphere is pushing down on the liquid outside, and the pressure of the vapor of the gas that's inside here is pushing down on there. And as this starts to transition, and they theoretically, when they become equal, that's the boiling point, but it happens so quickly that you don't see them actually being equal. What you see is this rapid return of the liquid into the capillary tube. And as soon as the liquid takes a turn and goes into the capillary tube, that's your measured boiling point. That's what we're actually looking for. So let me show you, if I may, if I can find it, a video. That's a photograph. That's a video. Okay, this is a video that I made some years back of a boiling point being taken. And on the left-hand side, you can see the thermocouple, the metal piece that is the temperature sensor. And in the middle well, you can see that the glass capillary tube fills the entire well from left to right. And in the very center is the inner dumbbell. And what you're seeing is the expansion of air off the inner dumbbell as the material is heating up. And so we're not at the boiling point yet. We haven't started boiling. All we're seeing is air expansion. And the only way that I know the difference between air expansion and true boiling is a rate. It's the rate at which the bubbles come out. So right now, I'm getting closer to the boiling point, but I can't tell when I actually transition from not boiling to boiling. So I'm still somewhere in the middle, but I'm getting closer to boiling as that rate is picking up and increasing. And eventually that rate is going to pick up and increase really fast, and I'm going to know that I'm above the boiling point. And so if I would look at the thermometer would tell me a temperature, and that temperature supposedly is above the boiling point. But I want to find what the boiling point actually is. So now I'm getting really close to boiling. In fact, I probably am boiling, but I'm going to heat it just a little bit more. And now as the bubbles really start coming out, now I'm going to turn down the temp. So I'll just turn the dial on the melt temp from something around 7 or 8, where I may have been heating really fast, to a temperature that's closer to like 3 on the dial. And the device is going to start to cool down. And as it starts to cool down, the bubbles are going to slow. And you're seeing this jumping up and down of the liquid level inside the inner capillary. Those are pressure changes happening inside the inner capillary. The inner capillary is not moving. It is the liquid which is jumping up and down inside the inner capillary. So I'm still boiling. Bubbles are still coming out of that inner capillary, but I'm getting little micro pressure changes. And what I want is I want to wait until the bubbles entirely stop. There, they just stopped. And the liquid transitions and goes back up into the tube with no more bubbles. Now is when I would read the temperature on the melt temp. That is the boiling point. Did you all catch it? Understand what it is I'm looking for? Eric's got it. All right, cool. Just making sure that everybody's following along. Okay, so let's jump back out of this. So that's how we do the boiling point. The boiling point is a process by which I usually take and turn the melt temp. So if I'm looking at melt temps, I'm at room temperature, then I'm heating. So my melt temp is set high. Melt temp is probably set like around 7 or 8. And then once I start boiling, when I cool it down, I take the melt temp and I turn down the dial to maybe 3 or 4. And the melt temp changes kind of slow. The melt temp is like a barge ship. It's very hard to turn. It's got a lot of thermal inertia in it. And so when I'm doing my rough approximation of my boiling point, I might use 7 or 8, 3 or 4. When I want to do a more nuanced boiling point, something that's going to get me a really good measurement for the boiling point, then I don't turn it up as high as 7 or 8. I sort of find my target temperature of where my boiling point, where I think my boiling point is. Remember those, that is such a bad line. Remember those boiling point curves that we had? And this was time, and this was temp. And that temp graph had all of those various temperatures on it. And we had all the various curves that came out that gave me the different temperatures at different times. And where I want to be is I want to be in the box where the temperature is not changing very much. So this might have been a setting of 3, 4, 5, setting of 2, setting of 1. And I would dial in my temperature, figure out where my melting point or my boiling point is approximately, use that setting on the melt temp to get close to it, and then just turn it down a little bit. So we do a rough approximation. This one would be rough. And then a fine one might be set at 3 and then down to 2. And so this would be a fine sort of one once I figure out where my actual boiling point is. The boiling points on these, on the unknowns ranged from 220 degrees Fahrenheit as their boiling point all the way down to, I think some of the smallest ones were in the 40s, 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So there was a huge range of what boiling point could be. And so to figure out where your boiling point was, it was good to do a rough approximation starting at 7 or 8 to heat and then turn it down to 3 or 4. But once you figure out where your boiling point is, then you can really dial it down and do a finer one. And what we're looking for is the goal is to get a boiling point that is within plus or minus 5. This should have been not Fahrenheit. These were Celsius. I apologize. We don't use Fahrenheit. What are we thinking about? Plus or minus 5 degrees Celsius of actual. And so what I had you guys do was take the boiling points and then check with me, see what your value was. I would tell you at your plus or minus 15, your plus or minus 10, your plus or minus 5, good to go. And then we move to the next phase. So that's kind of how the boiling point works. And in terms of boiling points, once the liquid takes a turn and goes up into the tube gets filled with liquid and you can't get the liquid back out again. So you have to reset a whole new sample every time you want to do this. You could, if you could get the dumbbell out, you could put in a new dumbbell and not have to refill the capillary tube every time. But it turns out that there's no real easy way to get the dumbbell back out of these once they're in. So we just scrap the whole thing, reset, make a whole new sample, go back and do it. It usually takes 2 or 3 trials, much like the melting points, in order to get a good boiling point. And it takes some practice to learn how to make the technique work. What I will say is that there are some keys to making this work. That one of the keys is that the capillary tube, actually two keys to success. Number one, make the capillary as thin as possible. While still being a tube. So if you have a capillary that is the inner capillary that is of large diameter and a capillary that is of a very narrow diameter, the narrow diameter is better. It gives finer bubbles, and the more viscous your material is, the better the smaller, narrower capillary tube is going to work. The other thing is the height of the capillary tube. The height of the capillary should be 2 times the height of the liquid. Can be taller, but at least 2 times the height of the liquid. What happens is when the air is coming out of the capillary tube and when the material starts to boil, you can imagine that it's like a little rocket ship. It's got this propulsive force as the bubbles come out of the capillary. And if the capillary tube is too short, then it jettisons itself out of the viewfinder and you can't actually see the bubbles. And so by making the capillary tube twice the height of the liquid inside the capillary, then it has enough mass to stay planted and you don't have to fight it as much. So if this is our outer capillary tube and the inner capillary tube and the closed up bead up on top, then what I want is a capillary tube that is at least twice as high as the liquid that's inside it. And that makes the whole thing work better. So those two things, keeping the capillary tube really thin and keeping it tall enough so that it has enough mass to stay down, those are the two keys to success for doing boiling points. Everybody hates boiling points. Boiling points are just a pain in the tuchus to do. They're a lot harder than melting points. Melting point, you just pack the material in, you get it in the capillary tube, you throw it in there, you're good to go. There's all this prep work and pulling out capillary pipettes and trying to get the dumbbell the right size and trying to close up the end of the dumbbell. And it's just a lot more work to take a boiling point. But in my mind, it's really not physically that much difficult or more difficult than it is taking a melting point. But people find it a little bit more challenging. All right, any questions on the boiling points themselves before I move into the FTIR and switch gears? I'm gonna give you guys a chance to kind of see where we're at. I think the video, more than anything, allows you to be able to see how it works and makes it a little bit more tangible. So everybody's good? No questions on boiling points or how that works? All right. At least I know Shelby's alive. Shelby's got a thumbs up. Oh, Eric's alive. I don't know who else. Nicole, okay. Elian, cool. All right. Once in a while, you guys got to let me know you're alive once in a while. All I've got is a black screen with everybody's name on it. You guys still aren't putting pictures up. Nobody wants to put a picture up. I mean, I can understand if you guys are hanging out in your pajamas, not wanting to have your camera on. That wouldn't be cool. Oh, nice. Mask Finn, you found one of the masks. That's cool. Did you find one online? Sweet. Yeah, that's a good respirator mask. I use mine all the time when I go out. Those respirator masks are killer. They've got a 0.3 micron. They're P100, which means that they filter out 99.97% of all particle sizes down to 0.3 microns, which basically keeps out everything, and except for the virus itself. But the virus itself isn't carried on air. The virus is carried on water droplets, and those droplets, P100s are oil rated and they keep out all liquids and oils out of them. So droplets aren't making it through that thing. Those are cool masks. Okay. Let's talk IR. So we will transition to infrared spectroscopy. Okay, I'm a little bit bummed in that our spectrophotometer is a really good spectrophotometer. It's really nice to use. We bought a research grade, state-of-the-art spectrophotometer probably about 5-6 years ago now. And the spectrophotometer, together with the computer and all the other components, comprises a system that was upwards of $27,000 for the entire system. And it was a big expense at the time, and I was able to get a grant from the college to be able to get it. And it's a nice instrument. And so teaching people how to use that instrument, we only tap a fraction of what that instrument can do, but it's a really nice instrument to learn on and to learn how to do FTIR. Let me grab, that's not where I want to go. Let me grab an image. This image here. So some of this stuff, the harder stuff to draw, I've been drawing just kind of as I'm hanging out in the evenings so that you don't have to sit here and watch me draw all these things. And then I'll bring them into our notes so that you have them in the notes when the notes get saved. This is the electromagnetic spectrum. And the spectrum ranges from X-rays to ultraviolet to visible to infrared to radio, and then out from there. And energy-wise, X-rays are used for X-ray crystallography. But X-ray crystallography is really a visualization technique where we bounce X-rays off of crystals. And so it is a type of a spectroscopy, but a little bit different than the way that light interacts with matter for most of these other things. So within the ultraviolet spectrum, there is a range from 200 nanometers on up to about 400 nanometers. And then from 400 nanometers up to 800, really the visible starts like around 430, 450. And goes up to about 750. Some people can see a little bit lower than 730 and a little bit higher than 750 up to about 800. But most people can see right in the 750 to 450 range. And the spectrum from 200 nanometers on up to 800 nanometers. So I'm looking, let's see, I need partial and let's use that as a pointer. That's the one thing that this app could use, is this app could use a pointer. It doesn't have that. So from 200 nanometers here on up to the 800 nanometers, that's in this visible to UV spectrum. And that is the UV-Vis spectrophotometry range. That's where we're looking at electronic transitions. Those are transitions of electrons from a ground state on up to an excited state. And we look at what it takes to promote that electron, how much energy it takes to promote that electron up to its excited state. That's in the UV and visible range. And that's the type of spectroscopy that you did in Chem 1B. So when you were using the spectrophotometers and you were calculating lambda max for a dye molecule, that lambda max was the absorption at its most intense for the compound in the ultraviolet to visible range. If you go up higher in energy, we go beyond the visible range, then we get into infrared spectrophotometry. And there is a range from 2.5 micrometers on up to 15 micrometers. And that's what's called the vibrational frequency range. There, what we're doing is we're putting energy into the molecule, and the molecule is absorbing energy relative to the vibrational frequencies within the molecule. So this is harmonic oscillations of vibrational frequencies themselves. So rather than messing around with electrons, we're actually making the molecule vibrate in different modes in this range from 2.5 micrometers on up to 15 micrometers. And that's what we're going to focus on today. We're going to focus on those vibrational frequencies. If you go up higher in energy, you get into radio waves, and in the 1 meter to 5 meter range of radio waves, there you're looking at nuclear magnetic transitions. That has to do with the nucleus. And so we look at the nucleus as a particle with a spin state. And there, when we put energy into that particle, the energy that hits the nucleus causes the nucleus to tip in a magnetic field. And once it tips, it precesses and it has higher energy because of that. So those are nuclear transitions. These others are vibrational frequencies where we get scissoring of the actual atoms themselves in different vibrational modes. So we can also have sort of like a two atom vibrational mode where things just vibrate like a spring on the bond. So we have electronic transitions, we have FTIR and Raman, which are vibrational frequencies, and we have NMR, which are nuclear frequencies. And what we tend to do is we look at these not in terms of their wavelength, but in terms of what is called wave number. And wave numbers are recorded in reciprocal centimeters. And I don't exactly know why we do that. I need to historically read why that's true and why we don't just deal with it in terms of wavelength. But it is historical and it is still common practice to use wave number in reciprocal centimeters for FTIR. So we're using wavelengths that are in the micrometers. A micrometer is 1 × 10⁻⁶ meters. That equals 1 × 10⁵ centimeters, which is 10,000. So 1 centimeter is 10,000 micrometers. So in order to convert from reciprocal micrometers to reciprocal centimeters, we need to take 1/micrometers and multiply it by 10,000. And that gives us reciprocal centimeters. So that's what's going on over here, is 1/micrometers × 10,000 is equal to a reciprocal centimeter. And all of the measurements that we're going to do are going to be in terms of reciprocal centimeters. So I don't have them in wavelength. I only have them written in reciprocal centimeters because that's the way that my brain works and thinks about them. And that's the way that we actually go through and measure them. Any questions so far? And remember, you guys can stop me at any point. You've been just letting me lecture for days since we've started this electronic format. You don't stop me very often. So I got to keep reminding myself to stop and ask if you have any questions. No? All right. Let's move on. Okay, from here, what we do is look at these vibrational frequencies. Oh, I should mention too that where do microwaves come in? So I have X-rays, ultraviolet, infrared, and radio, but I don't have microwaves in here. In between infrared and radio waves are microwaves. And when you think about microwaves and what a microwave does is that you put your food in a microwave, you turn the microwave on as a, not as a wave, but as a an object. You put your food in microwave and you turn it on and the microwave heats the food. Any idea how the microwave is heating the food? Silence, crickets. All right, well, what the microwave is doing is the microwave is tuned to the vibrational frequency of the water molecule. So the microwave at a specific frequency causes vibrational motion and rotational motion within the water molecule. So when you put food into the microwave, what you're literally doing is infrared spectrophotometry of the water molecule wavelength. And the microwave causes the water molecule to rotate faster. It absorbs the energy of the microwave, and that faster motion is translated into heat. And so literally what you are doing is you are heating the water molecules, causing the water molecules to accelerate their molecular motion, which molecular motion is equivalent to heat. And so the food heats up, and it only heats up as long as there's water in the food. If there is no water in the food, it doesn't heat up. So like a plate that has no water in it is unaffected by a microwave, a ceramic plate. But if that ceramic plate has gone through the dishwasher thousands of times and has little pockets of water within it, then when you put that plate, or it hasn't been fired properly and it has little pockets of water in it, when you put that plate in the microwave, the plate gets smoking hot because the water is literally being heated within the plate and can actually cause cracks within the plate and cause the plate to actually break. And that's just due from water heating inside the plate. It's also why paper towels and other things don't get so hot within the microwave, is that they just have very low water content. So that's where that goes. Okay, So these vibrational frequencies, literally what we're doing is taking a molecule that has elements in it. We can say mass one and mass two. And we treat these as the elements themselves, connected by a bond, which is a spring, and we add energy to it. This is our infrared wavelength, so infrared light. And what it does is it causes the bond to increase in vibration as long as the light is matched to the bond. So what that means is that the frequency of the oscillation dependent upon the two masses of the two atoms determines what the vibrational frequency of the bond is. And that bond will only absorb energy which is equal in frequency to the vibrational frequency. And that means that we can scan for all different types of vibrational frequencies. So what we see is that there are stretching types of frequencies. So we can look at a CH that can vibrate this way. This is a stretch. We can look at a bond that looks like this, like an alcohol. And this alcohol can go back and forth. And this would be considered a bending motion. So we can have two atom stretches, we can have three atom bends, we can also have four atom bends. There are all different types of vibrational frequencies. And just to give you some ideas, we can look at just carbon hydrogens, for instance. The carbon hydrogen bond for a CH2 group, this is a symmetric stretch. It's not what I wanted to do. So this is a symmetric stretch. And this has these guys extending out and then going back in. And this happens at approximately 2,850 reciprocal centimeters is what that frequency is. We can have an asymmetric stretch. Let's draw the molecule first. So stretches can be symmetric or asymmetric. In this case, one goes out, one goes in. So it's asymmetrical. This is happening at approximately 2,925 reciprocal centimeters. Then we can get things that look like this. This is a scissoring motion, and that's what we call it. That scissoring is happening at about 1450. We can get a rocking motion. You got to draw it right. Put my straight bonds on the wrong side. So the rocking motion looks like this, where this guy rocks up and this guy rocks up, so they swing back and forth. That rocking motion is a 750 reciprocal centimeters frequency. There can be wagging. So a wagging is kind of a cool idea. If we look at it this way, and we think about this plane as cutting through sort of this direction, then wagging is where these two guys are coming out of the plane in the same direction. That's happening at about 1250. And so one of the things that you're seeing here is you're seeing that for even just one functional group, there are multiple modes of vibrational frequencies that the molecule can absorb energy in order to have happen. So this is one, no, do not do that. This is one where one comes out that way and the other one goes out this way. This is called a twisting. And the twisting is at about 1250. So the twisting happens very similarly to the wagging at, but what it shows you is that for even very simple molecules, there are a large number of vibrational modes that can happen. And so when we take an infrared spectrogram, it looks generally like this. We get a percent transmittance. That just does not look square. Why is that so off? I'm gonna try one more time. I got a better way to do this. Okay, straight out, over, up. Nice, okay. We go from 400 reciprocal centimeters down to about 650 reciprocal centimeters. And so this is wave number on the x-axis. And on the y-axis, we have percent transmittance. Sometimes you'll see it in terms of absorbance, but it's much more common to see it in percent transmittance. So this is 100% transmittance at the top, 0% transmittance at the bottom, which means that there is no absorption of light. Or 100% absorption. Absorb, I need a P there. I don't know. I'm having a spelling trouble day. We'll get it right eventually here. Okay. So the absorption, the spectrum, looks something like this, where I see different functional groups. And then once we get into this side of the molecule, there tends to be lots and lots of absorptions that happen on this side. And there are some bands that are really critical bands. Let's see, is it supposed to be 4,000 or 400? It's supposed to be 4,000. So I did it right. It's 4,000 all the way down to 650, Shelby. So it's labeled correctly. The wave numbers, it's a broad range in terms of wave numbers. Thank you for asking that though. Yeah, because that looks like there's a whole magnitude of 10 there that looks like it should be different. And no, it's labeled correctly. So the ranges in here, let's do it this way. Let's use some gray color and a big label. This range sort of add in here. This is what we call the fingerprint area. The fingerprint range. And there is an area that is an important area that happens right in here. That is not what I wanted to have happen. This is the 1700 area. And then another area that is over here that is the 3500 reciprocal centimeter area. So this is 3,500 reciprocal centimeters. And then this area, let's see, another gray area here that we don't use as much. This area here is where we see carbon-hydrogen stretch. And because all molecules have carbon and hydrogen in it, that area where the carbon-hydrogen stretch is not all that important. This area, 3,500, this is where OH and NHs show up. So these are alcohols and amines. And the 1,700 is where carbonyls show up. And the fingerprint region is many, many different types of functional groups. And the problem is that when you look in this range that is really like around 1,500 reciprocal centimeters on down to 650, if you take a look at the different functional groups, and one, two, three, four, five, they have a lot of different functional groups which overlap each other and that come in these ranges. And so because so many different functional groups overlap each other that come in the 1,500 to 650 range, it's very difficult to point to a particular peak and to associate a peak with a functional group, because there are maybe 10, 15 different functional groups which will overlap each other in that range. And so we don't try to ascribe every single peak in the IR to a functional group. Instead, what we do is we use the fingerprint region, much like you would a fingerprint in a forensic sense, that you match it to a database, you scan through the database, you find a match, and when you find a match, no two molecules have the same fingerprint, just like no two humans have the same fingerprint. So that's how we use the fingerprint range. The 1,700 carbonyl range and the 3,500 hydroxyl group and NH range, those are much more diagnostic, and we use those to try to figure out whether or not our molecule has or does not have a hydroxyl group, whether it has or does not have a particular type of carbonyl. And the carbonyl in particular can be diagnosed further and can tell us what type of carbonyl. And you can think about all the different types of molecules that have carbonyls, that when we're looking at molecules that have carbonyls, you can think about aldehydes, ketones, you can think about esters, amides, carboxylic acids. You can alpha beta unsaturated ketones or alpha beta unsaturated aldehydes. You can have lactones or lactams that are linked up in rings. And so all of these different functional groups that have a carbonyl in them can be distinguished by the particular wavelength around 1700. And we would use a table then to look those up to figure out which carbonyl compound it actually is. So that's a little bit, and we're going to go in a few minutes, we're going to go more into that diagnosis of what those different functional groups are. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit more about how the spectrophotometer actually works. So the way in which the spectrophotometer actually works is we have a laser light source. So let's just put the laser light source here. And so this is our light source. And that light source outputs many different wavelengths of light. It gets passed through a monochronometer. Actually, I'm going to draw these a little bit bigger because it's not really doing what I want it to do. So let's try one more time. Light source. Monochronometer. So the light comes out of this guy, and the light source is generally a laser which can reproduce the wavelengths all the way from probably like 5,000 on down to 200 reciprocal centimeters is generally what those those light sources can do. Out of the monochronometer, so this is many wavelengths of light, which is coming out of the light source. The monochronometer then gives me a single wavelength. And what it does is it scans the spectrum. So the monochronometer has slits that are in the monochronometer that lets light in. And those slits then move. And as the instrument moves back and forth, it only allows certain wavelengths through the monochronometer. Then there's a really cool little mirror that's in here. And the mirror has a hole in the mirror. Some light makes it through the mirror. Some light is directed off the mirror. And it literally is a very cool parabolic mirror that has a hole in the parabolic mirror. The light that goes through the mirror is then redirected by another mirror so that the instrument is not a long, very linear instrument, but can be more box-shaped. So there's lots of mirrors inside it which direct the light around in different ways. The light coming off the mirror now takes and directs the material through a sample chamber. And the sample is of many different styles. There are many different style sample chambers, but basically what we have is a sample which is embedded between some sort of window material. And if the light source is coming through this, the light source will be absorbed by molecules in the sample relative to the frequency of their vibrational frequencies. And so now what we have is a light source which is diminished in frequency because some of the light has been absorbed. So this is the transmitted light. This is the incident light. We could call this light lambda nu naught to represent the light. This is lambda nu naught down here. And then our transmitted light is lambda nu final that has some frequencies that have been absorbed out of it. And those two light sources then are passed to a detector called an interferometer. So our instrument doesn't just measure the light absorbed, it uses what's called an interferometer to look at the difference from the incident light based on the light that was transmitted. And what it does is it compares the two wavelengths. When the wavelengths match exactly, the light you guys know that when we talked about bond formation and linear combinations of hybrid orbitals or of atomic orbitals, that we talked about disruptive and constructive interference. Light of the same frequency has no interference pattern. Light of the same frequency does constructive interference. So if I have two light waves, and those two light waves are of equal frequency, I need the whole one. And so what I want to do is take and make a light wave. Let's say that this is the propagating frequency of lambda nu. And I take that, copy it, paste it, and I add these two together. Then when these two add together, I get constructive interference. But if I take a light source, that this is my incident frequency, and another one that has some altered absorbance. So if I want to do an altered absorbance, then I'll do it this way. And this is the light that is coming out. Then as these two add together, I get destructive interference. And maybe some constructive in certain locations. And a pattern results. That pattern is usually what's called a beat pattern. The beat pattern looks something like this. It's called a FID, a free induction decay. And that beat pattern, when analyzed by a Fourier transform, can result in a line spectrum. And that's what we do, is we take the interferometer, and what comes out of this is a detector. It analyzes and looks for the beat pattern, and then it does a Fourier transform on it, which gives me then the line spectrums and tells me where the absorptions are within the line spectrum. And that gets printed out to the screen and is the output. So that's the entire process of how the instrument actually works. Let's take this sample chamber though, and let's look at the sample chamber here for a second, of how that sample actually gets constructed. There are many different types of sample chambers and many different types of materials that can be used for a sample chamber. The incident light that we are using is of an infrared spectrum, and organic molecules, all organic molecules, absorb in that infrared spectrum. So in order to be a window material, we need something that doesn't have covalent bonds in it, which means that we're restricted to those things that have ionic bonds in them. So what we do is we use a spectrum material that looks like this. So this is how our instrument is set up and designed to work. This is the sample holder. Okay, the sample holder has a metal base plate. That metal base plate has these studs, threaded studs on them in order to hook to the top base plate. We have a rubber washer that goes in. The rubber washer protects these sodium chloride plates from any excessive force applied when mounted in place and screwed down. And the main sample window material, so this is the window material, is made from sodium chloride. Sodium chloride, the exact same sodium chloride that you use as table salt. Literally what we use is a giant table salt crystal as a sample holder, because sodium chloride is ionic and doesn't have any absorbances in the 4,000 to 650 reciprocal nanometer wavelength. So it acts as a window in that 4,000 to 650 reciprocal nanometers. We put one drop of liquid on the plate, and then we sandwich the plate, we compress this whole thing, and then we screw down these locking nuts. So the locking nuts are up here. We screw down the locking nuts on top of it, just ever so gently. And we do it in a very specific way where we tighten them kitty corner. So what we would do is when we go to tighten this thing, I would tighten down this locking nut and this locking nut together very slowly and gently. And then I would do this locking nut and this locking nut. And we do it kitty corner like that in order to keep the compression on the plate even across the two sides. That way I don't crack the sodium chloride plates. If I were to just put tension on one side, there's the possibility that as the sodium chloride plate is sitting in here and I put too much tension on one side, I could crack the plate in half if I don't tension it in the way that I'm describing. So I go through and I tension it on one side, on kitty corner, and then I do the other kitty corner. And like I said, just loose in order to tension that guy. And then I take that whole holder and put that into the instrument, and the light travels through these open windows and through the sodium chloride, gets absorbed by the organic material that's placed in there, and then I actually get my spectrum. To clean them, because it's sodium chloride, what I do is I take the sodium chloride plate that has the sample on it, and let's see if I can just grab this sodium chloride plate. To clean it, we take the sodium chloride plate and we wash it with acetone, but not just any acetone. We take acetone that is in a squeeze bottle, and the squeeze bottle has that long sort of straw that fits down into it. And so this is acetone. And down the bottom, we put solid sodium chloride. And that means that the acetone is saturated with sodium chloride. So it's a saturated solution. In that saturated solution, what we do is we add it onto the plate, and then we use a chem wipe, a tissue, and we wipe it off with a tissue. And so we just very gently sort of crumple up tissue and go back and forth on the surface with it, sort of polishing the surface and removing any of that material. The material that we use are called chem wipes. The chem wipes are sort of like a lens paper. They're very soft and they don't scratch the sodium chloride plates. And we remove any of the contaminant off the surface. And the reason that we use sodium chloride like that is because if you take a look at solution and sodium chloride dissolved not in water, so it's not aqueous, it's in solution, in acetone. And down here you have sodium chloride solid, that this is in dynamic equilibrium. So for every particle of sodium chloride that dissolves into the acetone, another one precipitates such that the crystal does not change size. Even though acetone does not dissolve sodium chloride very well, because acetone is polar, sodium chloride is ionic, it does dissolve it a little bit. And we don't want anything to dissolve the sodium chloride crystal that is our window material. So we make sure that the acetone that we use is saturated with sodium chloride. And let's see what else. These windows are generally about 1 inch by 2 inches by a height that is probably like 10 millimeters. Is about the height of those plates. So they're actually pretty big, and they are clear like glass. When they're brand new, they don't have a scratch in them. And just by looking at it, you couldn't tell the difference between a plate of glass and that sodium chloride crystal. They cut them. I don't know how they cut them, but they cut them very regularly, and then they polish them to a high degree such that they are optically transparent, and the IR light just travels right through them. So we take that whole thing, and that's what goes in the sample chamber, and the light passes through a very thin film of the organic material. And IR is extremely sensitive. So it just takes one drop. And in order to get that one drop on the plate, the sample prep literally is, we take the plate and we put that one drop in place by using a pipette in your sample as a capillary tube. So we take a short stem pipette is all we need. And we draw up some of the liquid in the short stem pipette. We don't use a pipette cap on this, or a pipette bulb. And then you take the pipette and center it over it. We don't touch it to the surface. We leave it up above the surface. And then on here, we use that little trick of applying a little bit of thumb pressure. So we take and just apply a bit of thumb pressure on this and push downwards on it. And the small amount of pressure that we are applying causes the liquid that has been drawn up by capillary action into that to just drop a single drop out. And that's all we use, is a single drop of material. And then we put the second plate on top of it, and then we put it all inside the holder and tighten it down a little bit. And that's the whole thing. Now, once you run the spectrum, then we also have to teach you how to use the software on the spectrophotometer. We're not going to do that. We're going to forego the software, but we are going to talk analysis a little bit. And so we've already sort of set up this analysis idea of that there's two important bands within this. And we've talked about the reasons of why I don't look at some of these other areas. What I want to do is bring in another graphic that sort of highlights that. But before I do that, I want to ask if there's any sort of questions, either on the spectrophotometer itself, how it operates, or the sample preparation, or cleaning the sample plates, or any of that. So you guys are just telling me I'm just doing a rock star job here, and there's sort of no sort of questions. I'm getting applause, so I'll take applause. That's cool. Everybody else is doing all right? Okay. So let me grab another graphic. This is one of my favorite graphics. I found this years back, and this graphic here. And this graphic does and aligns with my ideas on IR spectroscopy better than anything I've seen. Trying to get it to pull out to a full page size, though, is going to be tricky. Okay. So what this graphic shows I have no idea what the beginning part here is. It says puddles and worms is the observation, and it must have rained is the inference. The observation is a peak, an IR band of this size and shape, and the inference is probably that functional group. The problem is as I was saying, that many functional groups can occur in exactly the same place, and that there are very few regions in the infrared spectrophotometry range where only one functional group happens to show up. Those two places are in the 3500 range and in the 1700 range. And so what this graphic does is it's showing you that that all IR bands are equal, but some are more equal than others, which is a funny way of saying that all IR bands are important, but some are more important than others. And that when we go through an IR chart, we'll see that the IR chart just goes in order of wave number and not in order of functional group. And so these organizing of tables in terms of wave numbers are not very helpful, because multiple functional groups can show up at the same wave number. And so this chart is saying there's a better organizational way to do this. And what they say is that there are areas of great interpretive power and areas of wimpy interpretive power. And they highlight four areas, and two of them being the most interpretive out of all of them. And so what they have here is this area, which is the hydroxyl group, and the NH group is one of the most interpretive areas. This is the area between 3400 and 3200. And actually, I include that all the way up to about 3500. This is the area that they are highlighting and saying that this area here is of most interpretive power, because hydroxyls and NHs are the only thing that show up in this range. And there is no other functional group which happens to show up here. Not only that, but the shape is really critical. So the shape of this line can tell you a lot about what the functional group is. And there is great interpretive power, both in the peak and in the shape of what is coming in this range. So these are the shapes, and yet these shapes are not well represented in the cartoon. We will take and look at these shapes in greater detail, but what we see is that a smooth shape, the first one here, denotes a hydroxyl peak. It is both broad and strong. So this is broad, smooth, and strong. The two sharp peaks, these are sharp and weak. These are denoting NHs, not any NH, but a primary NH when there are two peaks. When there's a single peak, sharp and weak in this range, it is either an alkyne proton, or it's a primary amine. Secondary. So this is a primary amine, this is a secondary amine. And this one that is jagged and fairly strong, this one is a carboxylic acid. I don't like the way they represent it, but there's the carboxylic acid. So the shape, even though they're cartooning this, does a pretty good job of telling you what type of functional group it actually is. So let's take that for a second, and let me draw some spectrums to show you sort of the differences in what we would expect to see for these different types. And then we'll do the same for carbonyls, and then I'll take you to a website where we can actually see what the different spectrums actually look like, okay? So from here, let's look in that 3,400 reciprocal centimeters on down to 3,200 reciprocal centimeters. And this is OH and NH for the most part. These guys, when it's a hydroxyl group, the hydroxyl group, and I'm going to copy this box so I don't have to keep redrawing my box. Cool. These guys tend to have a broad peak that is very smooth. I need to sit up to draw this. Come on. Has a broad peak, which is very smooth. And then a few peaks here and maybe a few other things. Then usually we get into some sharp stuff. This gets into the fingerprint region. There can be many long and short peaks all down in the fingerprint region. So there's lots of stuff that's usually going down in there. Strong usually means between 0 and 20% transmittance. Medium usually means between 20% on up to maybe 70% transmittance. And weak means usually in the 70% on up to like 95% transmittance. So there's our strong, medium, and weak. And we usually hit that strong, medium, and weak, S, W, or M, in terms of how we classify them. Broad is meaning something that has a lot of wave numbers in between. Sharp is something that is a very sharp peak. So not very many wave numbers in between it. This is classical hydroxyl. This is an OH denoting an alcohol. And we're focusing right in this range that is centered right around 3,100, actually, excuse me, 3,300. So we're looking at 3,400 on down to 3,200. And we're usually centered right around here, right around 3,300 reciprocal centimeters. And these are usually strong and broad. And the great thing is that if you have an alcohol, it's there. And if you don't have an alcohol, it's not there. And so it's really a great diagnostic tool. And the reason that they're broad, this is even a nice little thing, is that the reason that they're broad is that if you think about an alcohol, alcohol's hydrogen bond. And because of the hydrogen bonding that takes place, there are many different many different bond lengths that are in here that are being represented. And each one of those bond lengths is going to have a slightly different wavelength. And so literally what you're getting is you're getting all these little sharp wavelengths that correspond to the different bond lengths that are being represented in the hydrogen bond, and they add up to this very broad hydroxyl peak. So it has to do with the hydrogen bonding that's happening. And what's really cool is that if you break the hydrogen bonding by using a different solvent or by using some other cool structure that doesn't hydrogen bond but still has a hydroxyl, then what happens is the hydroxyl resolves into a sharp peak. And so this can be a non-hydrogen bonding hydroxyl. Still happening in the same range, I'm gonna leave my fingerprint pretty long there. This is a non-H bonding hydroxyl, which is sharp. One of the reasons that can happen is, for instance, if we're doing analysis on a molecule that has some steric hindrance around the hydroxyl such that hydrogen bonding can't happen because it can't get physically close to the hydroxyl in order to hydrogen bond, you remove the hydrogen bonding, you remove the broad swoopy thing, you get a sharp peak centered around the 3300. So that's how you know the difference between hydrogen bonding and non-hydrogen bonding. When we look at a carboxylic acid is generally the same intensity as a hydroxyl group. They're related to hydroxyl groups, but the carboxylic acid generally has a lot of definition to it. It has structure to it. And we recognize that sort of as the hairy beard is what they say in the cartoon, is that this is a carboxylic acid representation that is not smooth, still broad, and it comes about because carboxylic acids like to dimerize as opposed to having many different types of frequencies. So they dimerize in their hydrogen bonding. And that means that they have many different or many less vibrational frequencies than alcohols. And therefore you see the individual frequencies that are giving rise to this. So I get a frequency that is here, that is here, that is here, a frequency that is here and here. And so you see more of the individual frequencies from the dimer than you do from something that is networking hydrogen bonding, much like the alcohol. So that's where that comes from. The amines tend to be a little less intense. So in an amine, what I would typically see is I still get sort of an intense peak there. But the amines tend to be less intense and very characteristic in their shape. So this would be a primary amine, and it would have the two peaks on it. If I'm looking at a secondary amine, then the secondary amine has one peak, and generally it's not as sharp as an alcohol, so you can tell it apart from an alcohol in just how sharp it is, how intense it is. So this would be an RNRH. This is a secondary amine showing up like that. So we can see the differences in those. Let me switch from this view really quick, and let me go to a site that you can use that will show you the different spectrum. Okay. So let me dump out of this. And And let me show you how I find this site. I usually search for Japan spectroscopy database. The Japan spectroscopy database has a specific name to it. It is a free site. It is the National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology, AIST, and it's out of Japan. And it's a fantastic spectral database, number one, because it's free, number two, because of how many molecules it actually has in it. You just agree to their disclaimer. And the really cool thing here is that I can search for molecules by so many different ways. I can search by compound name, partial match, molecular formula. I can search molecular weight in a range, CAS registry number, the SDBS number. I can use percent of carbons, hydrogens, nitrogens in ranges. I can search for the type of spectrum that I want. I can search on specific IR peaks, such that if I have an unknown compound, I can put the IR peaks in here with pluses or minuses and commas separating out the different peaks, and it will find matches for me and give me compounds to compare to. For carbon NMR, I can do the same thing. Proton NMR, mass spectroscopy, it's an amazing database. And so let's search for butanol. I'm not getting a cursor for some reason. I may have frozen. Nope. Okay, I'm back up. So let's search for butanol. And within butanol, you'll see all the different compounds because I'm getting partial searches too. Let's choose one butanol and we'll look at its IR. Oops, you are not seeing what I'm doing. Hold on. Damn it, I forgot to do. Why are you guys just letting me go? Stop broadcasting, come back to this app, share this screen. All right, back up. All right, here's what I did. Japan spectroscopy database. It's the way that I remember it. And it comes up AIST. And once it comes up, you go in and you agree to their disclaimer. And then all the things that I just said, here's the way that I search. Those are all of the compound name, molecular formula, molecular weight, CAS registry, SDBS number, all of those different things, the number of atoms, the type of spectrum you want, everything. Let's search for butanol. Butanol brings up a large number of hits because it is doing a partial search. So everything that has butanol in it, it's finding all of those. Here's the one butanol right here. And I am going to choose the IR spectrum. The IR spectrum will bring me up a number of different IR types, but it also brings up mass spec and other things such that if I want to switch to the other types of spectroscopy for this molecule, I can do so from this window without having to back up. So I am going to choose the IR liquid film, make sure that I've got the right one, and this is it. And you can see the hydroxyl peak here and how broad and how smooth the hydroxyl peak is. The peak that is right next to it is the carbon-hydrogen stretch. Every molecule has carbon and hydrogen in it. And then down here is the fingerprint region. So I ignore the carbon-hydrogen stretch because while its shape is important in a fingerprint sense, its presence is not important because all organic molecules have carbon and hydrogen in them. So I just ignore it for the most part for right now. Fingerprint, for right now, I'm ignoring it too. I just want to focus on the shape of a hydroxyl group. Let's go get butane without the hydroxyl and look at butane without the hydroxyl. So we will return to search and we'll get butane. Oops, that's not butane. Isobutane. To butanol, butane's too small, it's not gonna have butane. Let's go with hexane, it'll be close enough. Pentane should be in there, pentane's a liquid. Butane's a gas, So it's not surprising that it's not in there. There's pentane. There's the IR. And you see the carbon-hydrogen stretch, but you see the absence of the hydroxyl peak. So looking at this, I know that there's no hydroxyl in this compound because of the lack of the hydroxyl peak that's there. So no hydroxyl, no alcohol. Carbon-hydrogen stretch, and then these are just the hydrocarbon component, the fingerprint that's there. Let me get another alcohol, return to search. And let's get hexanol. Here's a 2-hexanol. Notice that there's a sharp peak here. What we're looking at is we're looking at the IR in CCl4 solution. So this is part of the carbon tetrachloride that I'm observing. I'm going to go to the liquid film, and we should see there's the nice broad hydroxyl peak. The liquid film is what we always want to view. That would be in the sodium chloride plates. You get the carbon hydrogen stretches, and you get the rest of the fingerprint region. So there's the alcohols. Let's go back and look for a carboxylic acid, because that was the next thing that we compared. So let's get a carboxylic acid that would be hexanoic acid. Get the IR. And we'll make sure we're in the liquid film. Okay, this hexanoic acid has the jaggedness of what I'm talking about. Not as classically as I would like. It's jagged right through here. These are the carbon hydrogen stretches, which are stretching through it. But it does have the jaggedness in the range that I'm looking for. So that's the hexanoic acid. Also listed here is a 1700 peak. That 1700 peak is listed at 1711. The 1711 is coming from the carbonyl. And that's the next functional group that we're going to look at is carbonyls. So this is a good spot to see it, though, is that the carboxylic acid in combination with the carbonyl defines a carboxylic acid. Let me go find one more that may be more classic. I wanted to return to search. Let me get benzoic acid. There's a really classic carboxylic acid. So here you're seeing the jaggedness, not smooth at all, that defines what a carboxylic acid is. Also having that deep 1700 peak that's there. This one's at 1689, very close to 1700. So both the carboxylic acid and the carbonyl peak are there. Let's get an amine and see, we said that there were the amine compounds. Let's look to see what an amine looks like. Butylamine. So here is the butylamine with the two peaks for the butylamine that would mean that this is a primary amine. And there's the carbon hydrogen stretch and the fingerprint region. So these are a little bit more intense than what I normally would think of, but that's sort of the relative intensity that we would see with an amine, something like that. Let me return to search. Let's see if I can find a secondary amine. Ethyl amine. And there's the one-sided, so just the one peak that denotes the secondary amine, correlating with structure down here. So you can see the structure rather than just having to rely on my words. So the structure is always located in the lower right-hand corner. These are the carbon-hydrogen stretches, which are significant, and then the fingerprint region as we go into there. Okay, so we've hit alcohols, carboxylic acids, primary amines, secondary amines, and let's look at some carbonyl compounds while we're here. Return to search. Let's get benzo Fenone. Benzophenone IR. And let's make sure that we're in the Nugel. No, KBR disc. That's what I want. Okay. Notice here that the carbon hydrogen stretches are really tiny, that there's no chain, there's no CH2 groups on this. This has two aromatic rings, and because of that, the CH is a very tiny peak. Also, there is no alcohol or primary amine or secondary amine. There's a total absence of functional groups in this area. What there is a very sharp peak that is close to 1700. This one is 1666. That 1666 peak denotes that this thing is a carbonyl compound. And the type of carbonyl is denoted by the specific frequency, whatever frequency, oh, I can't click on that, is showing up at. That 1666 frequency tells me what type of carbonyl this is. And we're going to go back and I'm going to show you the types of carbonyls that we have. But the carbonyl is either there or it is not there. If the carbonyl is there around 1700, you've got a particular type of carbonyl, and then we go to a table to figure out what type of carbonyl it is. If it isn't there, you don't have a carbonyl of any type, which throws out a whole class of different types of compounds. So let me, unless there's any questions about the database and about the compounds, I want to switch back to the tablet and do a little bit more drawing, and we're almost done, but let me ask if there's any questions in this piece here. Now, you guys doing all right? Okay, so let me switch out of this. I'll stop screen sharing and start broadcasting on the tablet and go back to this graphic. This graphic has the second most powerful interpretive area or region as the carbonyl region. This is the region that's centered on 1700. And so if I go and grab sort of the orange marker, actually they don't have this highlighted out. They don't have a whole spectrum here for me to look at. But what they're saying is that 1700 range is the carbonyl range. And so down here, 1700 reciprocal centimeters, this band that extends all the way out to about 1780 on down to about 1630. This is the band that is the band that they're talking about where carbonyls show up at. And so what we typically see is just the carbon hydrogen stretches. We can see some other little things that happen in here. But then in the 1700 range, we'll get a very sharp peak. And it usually is a peak that is very strong. It's usually the strongest peak. That we see in there. And that peak can show up between, and this is the carbonyl. Depending upon its frequency, it can tell you what type of carbonyl it is. So notice here that we have acid chlorides at around 1800. We have anhydrides showing up at 1760 and 1810, esters at 1735, aldehydes at 1725, ketones at 1715, acids at 1710, and amides at 1690. And all of these peaks can be shifted as much as 30 reciprocal centimeters by conjugation or by ring strain. So by conjugation, what we're saying is that it can be conjugated on the oxygen side by a double bond, or it can be conjugated on the carbonyl side of the double bond, and that those conjugations shift it different directions depending upon the type of conjugation. The ring strain has to do with having tight four-membered or five-membered ring systems that that increase ring strain, and that can also shift, and it shifts in particular directions. We can have a blue shift or a red shift. So a blue shift towards lower reciprocal centimeters, higher reciprocal centimeters, or a red shift towards lower reciprocal centimeters. And so I don't get too much into the shifts as much as I do going from a table and using a table such as Impavia. That when you get a 1700 peak and you know it's a carbonyl and you want to figure out what type of carbonyl it is, we go back to Pavia and to one of the tables in the back of the appendix, Technique 25, which has the infrared spectrophotometry. And in there, there are tables that will tell you the specific wavelengths and what type of carbonyl compound you might actually have. So if I didn't have this table screenshotted, but if I take and go to my camera and show you Pavia over here, what I can screen share with you is that Pavia has tables in it, and it has small, weak, strong, medium, weak. It has the wavelengths, and then it has the different types of carbonyls here. So we've got ketones, carboxylic acids, esters, amides, and hydrides, and the ranges with which we would find those functional groups. There's also a specific table that will show you which way it will get shifted based on ring strain or conjugation. So there are smaller tables within Pavia as well. And what we typically do is we typically find a table that we like to work with when we're doing IR, and we just bring that table up when we're actually working with IR spectrums. And then we analyze those peaks. So we don't analyze every peak. What we analyze are just those two very strong interpretive areas, the 3400-3500 area, which has the alcohols in it and the amines, and the 1700 area where it has the carbonyls. And I know there are many other functional groups, and there are huge tables that you can find online, and other instructors will typically hand out tables that are great big tables with all these different functional groups on it. And students can spend a tremendous amount of time looking through the tables, trying to figure out what functional groups they have, looking at their spectrum and trying to analyze it and diagnose it. And the crux of it is that that's overwhelming and not helpful in a beginning situation. Focus on the two most powerful interpretive areas, and you will get through most of IR with just those two areas. And then the rest of it comes down to a fingerprint scan. Finn, I'll get the question in a second. There are other areas which are also interpretive, but those are best left for later on. Like when we get into the spectroscopy section within the lecture section, we'll use this as our foundation for IR, and then we'll expand on it a little bit, and we'll add some other functional groups and look at some other things that can help us discern between different types of functional groups. Okay, Finn, why aren't there any alcohols in the graph? You mean in the table in Pavia that I just showed? In the table in Pavia, there are alcohols, but they were down lower, and I didn't scan down low enough with my camera to show you those. But I was looking at page 879 in version 4 of Pavia, and there certainly are those alcohols that are in there. So those are absolutely there. All the different functional groups, there's big tables within Pavia. It's not just one page of tables. There's multiple tables and multiple tips on going through and analyzing IRs. And I just didn't show you all of that because I don't feel that it's really helpful at this point right now. And I sort of deal with those a little bit more one-on-one with students and introducing them. Sadie is just deciding to freak out in there. I don't know exactly why. But we've reached close to the end of the lecture and just about everything that I wanted to show you. And next lab, what I would do is spend more of our time interpreting spectra, giving you guys spectra, giving you the chance to interpret them, and then working with you how I would interpret those. So that's kind of where I think I'd like to leave it for today, and just open it up for questions And I've been talking now for, 2 hours, and my voice is about to give out. So let me know if you've got any questions. And if not, I'm happy to call it a day here, and then we'll pick it up on Wednesday, and we'll actually put it into practice on Wednesday. Okay? Hey, you guys are welcome. Be safe out there. Stay healthy. And I'll see you on Wednesday. You guys are most welcome.